Arthur Sulzberger Jr., chairman of the New York Times Company, and Barry Diller, chairman and CEO of IAC Interactive Corp. and chairman of Expedia Inc., spoke about media at the Web 2.0 Summit 2006. This podcast is brought to you by the Intel Software Partner Program. Imagine a world technology leader as your partner, your business partner, your development partner, your marketing partner. Get an advantage in the Intel Software Partner Program. Join today at www.intel.com/partner. Here's Web 2.0 Summit Program Chair John Battelle in conversation with Barry Diller and Arthur Sulzberger.
All right, next up, this is a great conversation between two very well-known people in the media and internet space. Arthur Sulzberger, the chairman of the New York Times Company and the publisher of the New York Times, and Barry Diller, the chair and CEO of Interactive Corp. May I ask you guys to come on up? And while you're coming up, I'm sitting here. You guys sit here. I have to, you know, we have to give the biggest sport award to Barry, so I want to tell this story. Have a seat. I had a call scheduled with Arthur last week.
This is, I feel like Eloise at the Plaza. I mean...
I'm sorry. I'll get a bedboard in for you.
Thank you.
What does that mean?
Reinforcement. Eloise at the Plaza?
We'll keep
it's
going.
It's an old story.
We got time, but we'll get to that. So let me finish with...
Aren't we a little close?
I had a call with Arthur to prepare for this and last week. And I did my usual research, look for stories that might pertain to both of you. And I found Geraldine Fabricant's story about your pay package. Which I read with great interest. Actually, I had already read it, but I reread it with great interest. And then I asked Arthur about that. I said, won't it be a tiny bit uncomfortable, you two being on the same sofa, with the Times kind of beating Mr. Diller up a little bit? And Arthur said, no, I'm sure it'll be fine. It won't be any problem. And then I found out that you had even taken that a little bit further.
This is true. On behalf of all of us in this room, most of us who are incredibly jealous.
I'm sure this is going to be really sweet.
I want to present to you this plaque of that story.
Arthur.
All right.
How sweet
with a
you
beautiful
are.
Photo. And here's the good news. The drinks are on Barry.
Yes. Arthur, could you move that way? This is nice. It's almost as good as the one I made for myself.
I couldn't afford that one.
Okay.
All right.
Well, we're done with that.
Now we've managed to break that ice.
You made me do it.
Let me start this way. Both of you run businesses with lots of different moving parts. And we just had Eric here speaking about his business. Both of you have companies that both partner very deeply with Google and compete in many ways. You've got Ask.com, which is both partner and competitor. Mm-hmm. You've got About.com, mm-hmm. which is a very strong partner. And then you've got a lot of advertising-driven businesses. Mm-hmm. Where maybe you're not so sure whether or not you're a partner or a competitor. So maybe we can start with, picking up the narrative thread from the last conversation, what do you make of Google? Friend or foe?
If you're asking me, very much a friend. In fact, Google is now the largest business partner of the New York Times Company, the largest single business partner.
You don't find that to be a threat?
On the contrary, we are delighted by them. Especially at About, very important relationship with About, and I think everybody understands that. At the New York Times, it's clear that they are not in the reporting journalism media space, but I think it's clear also from the conversation that you had with Eric that they are in the advertising space. Well, they're a competitor, they're a good competitor, they're also a cooperator, and we're going to have to see how this all develops, but it's an exciting partnership that we have entered into, and we like that.
Barry?
I think the world is going to be more and more about competing and joining with. I think that as these things converge and converge, it's going to be impossible not to. And so long as you all know which camps you're in and where you're in, where obviously you're cooperating together, partnership or whatever you want to call it, or a client relationship or whatever, then that's fine. And then you go in the other room and you bash the hell out of each other. Now, now, so long as you do it with the knowledge of these multiple hats that you wear, it balances itself. It's okay. It's okay in life to do that. If you actually had some approach which is, because you compete with me, I'm never going to talk to you about anything, or I'm going to try and do anything I can, that is won't work today, and certainly ain't going to work tomorrow.
Do you fear that?
I answered that very artfully about Google, don't you?
Well, I did, but I'm going to dig in a little bit.
Ah, sweetheart.
Do you? I asked Eric this question. Are you concerned at some point that because of its market dominance or because of the fact that it's hiring thousands of salespeople, some away from the New York Times, some away from Time Inc., that at some point you become Google's, well, basically the inventory for Google to sell, as opposed to an independent business? Do you worry that perhaps there may come a time when you're too dependent on them?
No, I don't worry about that.
I don't either.
Can I ask why?
Because I don't believe that, I just don't believe that the world coves in it particularly, and again, redundantly, but the world doesn't cove to one, certainly in the media, in anything called media. It's just not possible that it's all going to be in one place. Leadership will be leadership, and frankly, I don't care who's, this whole concept, the GE concept of number one and number two, first of all, in the media world, that's absurd. And media businesses have been around with 4, 5, 7 principal players changing positions at various times, with one company sometimes being, you know, in the lead of it for 7 years or some very long cycle. So I just don't think it's going to be an all or nothing world. I can't believe that that's possible.
Right. Both of you run, sort of related to that, both of you run businesses that are very much about brand. As a matter of fact, you've described IAC as a stable of brands, and the New York Times is the, you know, sterling brand in news. How do you find your brands changing and shifting as you try to move them from a business model of sort of packaged goods media, so to speak, to the web, which is a very sort of, where you're not seeing as much revenue, although it's growing much more quickly? I'm particularly curious about the Times.
Well, let me set the stage just briefly for the New York Times Company, because I think most people don't know that we are, in fact, the 10th largest internet company in the world in terms of page views coming in. That's at About, that's at the New York Times on the web, that's at the Boston.com and other properties. So we've not only embraced this world, we've suddenly found ourselves in a somewhat of a leadership position. The New York Times in particular, because I think you asked about that in particular, is long, we've long had the mantra, we are and must be platform agnostic. That it's not about the paper that makes newspapers exciting, it's about the news that makes newspapers exciting. So the work that you're seeing us do on the web is sort of a core element to what we are now. Translating that into a business model that is able to sustain the enterprise going forward is the key to sort of rebalancing our business.
But can you pay for the New York Times journalists on New York Times online revenues?
No, and thank goodness I don't have to. The New York Times is on the web, is profitable, is growing at a tremendous rate. I mean, we're very excited by that. But we still have the print vehicle, which is you know, in some areas struggling more than others, but it's still a highly profitable business operation. So right. we're not facing a moment where we have to make a decision. We're going to continue to grow, we're going to continue to expand, and the digital advertising is there and it is coming to us.
Now the pieces at IAC that are advertising driven, how are they doing, and are they the fastest growing, aren't they, the online advertising pieces of your business?
Well, I mean, actually, there are some other parts of the company in transactions that are growing faster, but they're growing really quite well. I mean, they're certainly the query growth at ask.com has averaged about 30% growth on the clock almost every day this year, for about a year, or since we made the change to ask.com and
ditched the killing Jeeves.
Ditched the Jeeves. We didn't kill him. He's somewhere.
I saw a Google engineer came back as zombie Jeeves for Halloween.
Yes?
Yeah.
Good. That's where Jeeves is. So yeah, advertising is for us growing well.
Now, as a media person and a brand guy, what's your strategy with regard to new forms of content? Like, you bought College Humor, or a majority share of College Humor.
No, right? We bought it. I don't want to say it that, you know, that sounds cruel, but we did buy it.
Right. Are you going to be buying a lot more sites like that?
I don't know. I mean, we're certainly interested. We're also interested in creating them. I mean, one of the things that I think that is great now, the time has now come when I think you can put real capital into creating programming of all different kinds and lengths and cuts and text, video, combinations thereof, et cetera. And I think this is, it's not yet really there, but in the next couple of years, for certain, I'm quite sure that being able to create programming, and I don't mean that to create 1 minute or 2 minute pieces, and I certainly don't mean that you're going to make a theatrical motion picture for the internet, but different hybrid forms. Pure, actual program creation now is the moment, I think at least, that you could justify putting real capital in, so we're going to do so.
Is that going to be part of the strategy of the New York Times, or are you going to more hew to the original brand promise of news?
Well, news is core.
Because About.com is...
Yes. Well, About.com is its own entity, and it's almost a form of citizen's journalism,
right?
In a real way. But for the Times, at the core of what we offer is journalism, and that can't ever change. That's the brand promise. What has to change, however, is our vision of how we interact with the community and how we allow our users to not only get the news and information that they want from the Times, but integrate into what we offer the blogs that they want, or the blogs they don't know what they want, that they want. If Tom Friedman every morning were to say, here are the three blogs that I think you ought to read today, That's a pretty powerful tool,
yeah,
and that's where we are moving and should be. So to give more greater ability for the Times to be part of the many conversations that are taking place on the web.
However, the conversations that Tom Friedman has now cannot be pointed to by people with blogs because it's behind the paywall of Times Select.
With the exception,
except
of
for
this week.
Now, did you notice that Arthur made it free this week?
I'm not as dumb as I look.
I think there was a plan there.
Yes. Yes, you're right. Times Select, with the exception of this week, is a pay site. Now, that doesn't mean that all parts of what Tom Friedman does have to be part of a paid site. But Tom is. And so are our other op-ed columnists and many people who don't appear in the printed pages, because it is a much more robust site than merely
How
our
is that columns. Going?
It's going well. It's a year into it. We're in the midst of our the annual re-up. We have 550,000. Let me rephrase this. If Times Select was a newspaper that was part of the New York Times company, it would be our third largest newspaper after the Boston Globe and the New York Times.
Are the writers happy behind that wall?
I think they understand, as do we all, that quality journalism is expensive. That if you're going to have the number of people we have in Iraq, that is an expensive proposition. If we're going to give Tom and other columnists the ability to pick up at a moment's notice and wind up in somewhere around the world, that's an expensive proposition, and we need to sustain that. It would be great if the New York Times in print were free. It would be great. It is not, and that is to sustain our journalism.
It's election day. Both of you have been known to hold opinions. I'd like to ask yours, not of any current races.
Why not?
Well, okay. But I would like to ask about some policy issues. What, as you run your companies, as you look at the internet industry broadly and its place in the world, what are some of the major issues that you think our elected officials should be paying attention to and that we should be paying attention to that perhaps we're not?
Your turn.
Well, I mean, obviously, I think you said you're going to do a debate. How there could be a debate on net neutrality is beyond me. Who's on the other side of it?
Well, we found a guy from Cisco.
Other than Ed Whitaker and some...
Well, we found the guy that sells a lot of hardware to Ed Whitaker.
Yeah, okay, so that would count. But they're totally disqualified. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's impossible to argue against net neutrality. We have this magic box and this magic thing that we get to push a button and publish to the world. It's an accident. It's the first time in the history of media that there haven't been distributors, there haven't been people who say, well, it's a scarce resource, and therefore we're going to dole it out to you on the basis of how much you'll pay us. This is push a button, publish to the world with nobody between the creator or originator and the consumer. How we could let that go potentially awry by people whose stated position is that they're going to do that. They're going to, and it's... And everybody, all of us live in the only thing that we have to worry about, because connectivity is now assured. I mean, now we don't need to worry that eventually we got pretty good bandwidth now. We're gonna have a fat enough pipe, and so the infrastructure is assured. The only danger is that we screw up the very basis on which that thing works. That system works. So I think everybody's got to get very voicey about this, particularly in this next Congress is the ground for it. If it will either happen, I believe, in this next Congress, or I don't think it'll happen at all.
Arthur, what do you?
There's nothing that Barry said that I disagree with on net neutrality. For those of us in the journalism game, there are other issues out there, and I want to commend Eric on what he said about the rights of privacy, the rights to keep the information flow open. That's been a big battle for the New York Times and for many of our colleague newspapers over the last few years.
You've locked horns over issues of right to publish.
Right.
With the White House, even going to the extent of holding on a story for a while in deference until you decided that you couldn't hold anymore.
Until we decided, as we continued to report the story, and this is the NSA wiretapping story that you're talking about, until we were convinced by continuing to report that story out that the assurances we had received from the administration were not, in fact, as valid as they had laid out them to be, at which point we realized, and these are, it's a, for a story like this, it's always a balance between national security on the one hand and civil liberties on the other. And newspapers are surprisingly good at making that balance. Not every time perfect, but surprisingly good. And it became clearer and clearer as we continued to report the story that the civil liberties part was weighing heavier and heavier. And that's when we made the decision to publish.
Do you think that companies such as Ask, for example, or IAC, even the New York Times, certainly Google, who hold a lot of information about where people go, what they do, what they look for, what they do when they get there, and so on, might also have to make those kinds of balanced decisions in the future?
Sure you do. But like anybody, you know, if you run a department store, you know a lot about people. You don't tend to say, you know, there's this big fat woman in the closet there, and you don't tend to treat your customers badly. So you do make judgments all the time. You have lots of information, and if you don't serve your customers, which means that you serve them and you respect them, then you're going to be a dead duck. But you do have to weigh. It gets more and more complex because the process of information gathering, how you segregate it, who gets their hands on it, how do you protect it, all of these things, because of the immensity of it, it's in so many distributed hands that mistakes are going to get made,
right,
for sure.
Right.
And the challenge is not just in this country. Eric spoke eloquently about that, but the challenge is increasingly internationally.
Yes.
And it's not just the laws of the United States you now have to recognize. It's the fact that if you are going to be in China, you've got a different set of laws.
Right.
And so on around the world. That makes this immensely more complex.
Let me, you mentioned blogs before and the conversation, and I want to bring this up because, Barry, when we spoke last, you brought up, I brought up user-generated content, and you didn't exactly poo-poo it, but...
How could I? Most of the stuff we have is user-generated content. How do you think Match.com survives? It isn't us that's making up the flirt, you know?
But you did say that you didn't think that...
No, I said something...
You gave the impression,
I said something different. What? I'm kind of leading the witness, but...
lead on.
No. I mean, I said, and I believe, that the talent pool... The talent pool is finite. There are only so many people of the kind of talent that is going to resonate really widely.
Right.
Now, there are going to be, obviously, there are people who are, I mean, anybody is capable of making up something that four people are going to like, or 44, or people who were in their family, or other things like that. And every once in a while, something is going to come along that, whether it's the dancing person in the bathtub or whatever it's going to be, that's going to be a flash and people, but that's not what I'm talking about in terms of talent. What I'm saying is there are only a group of people in the whatever amount you would like to call them. It's not in the hundreds of thousands, I promise you. And those talent outs, and that is the pool that is we're going to depend upon, as we always have, for things that are going to generate to wide audiences.
Right.
So.
Right. What's your view of the user-generated content?
I'm going to put myself in Barry's camp. It's a wonderful thing that people have the ability to now post their opinions, post their information, and in some cases even, rarely, post their knowledge on a web. And
now,
and make
Arthur.
it, oh, come on, I had to throw something out like that. And it is a wonderful thing that all of us and the rest of the world has the ability to access that. Those are good things. Speaker's Corner writ large. But at the end of the day, we're making a bet, as we have for over 150 years, that quality information, that information you can trust, not information that is inexorably accurate. It is not. We're a human institution and we make mistakes. But information that is processed, thought about, and when the mistake's made, corrected, plays a role in a democracy, particularly in a democracy when all of us on this day enter a voting booth and need to know what it is you're pulling the lever for.
Isn't though there, would you agree that perhaps there's a model for more good information? In other words, there is only so many outlets, the New York Times or Fox.
Yes,
now,
I do.
Now, a fellow who is extremely talented at reporting on the local school board.
Absolutely.
When most of the local papers, I have some statistics here, daily circulation of the LA Times down 8%, the Chronicle 5.3%, the New York Times 3.5%, the Boston Globe 6.7%. There are four reporters in my local paper where I live in Marin. Four. And they don't cover the school board where I live anymore.
Absolutely. And this is important. So, and newspapers have to and are making increasing use of that kind of journalism.
Tapping
because
into
it
that
can be.
Talent.
Tapping into it, but making judgments about it. And saying, in our judgment, we think this is news, this is information and opinion that is valuable, that is worthy of your time, and we're not going to be able to make all the choices,
well, really,
but we're going to make some.
You're talking about editorship.
Right.
And I don't think editorship is going away. As a matter of fact, I think it's going to be even more prized in the future. So while everybody would like to believe that their entrails are of great interest to everybody, it's just probably not so.
Well, I'm arguing for sort of an amateur class of people who are very good at doing a few things, whose talent would never have made it to the pages of the New York Times. But because they're extremely good at covering the school board, county.
And we need to embrace
that. That's a
that.
New form of talent. That,
absolutely.
Sure.
And we need to embrace it, and we are embracing it.
It's a different... sorry, please.
No, go ahead.
No. I'm using the word talent in a different...
I understand. My talent to reach wide audiences.
My definition is really different. And you misconstrue meaning if you think that what I'm doing is being negative or saying that, you know, that the great amount of people in the great long tail, you know, have nothing to contribute to anything. I don't believe that at all.
Well, now that that's cleared up, let's go to questions. Can we start over here?
Yeah, my name is Alan Worms. I'm with Participate Media. And among other things, we publish realclearpolitics.com. And, you know, we're going to do 40 million page views this month. I don't know exactly how many unique visitors. We did more than this in the 2004 election. Excuse me. Our site is primarily editors. And I think it's a little bit, I don't want to say condescending, but the fact is I think that a lot of people are creating content in areas that mainstream media have not focused on or have not delivered on. And you need to recognize that there are a lot of great people out there who are going to have the opportunity now because costs are so low to deliver that kind of content. And it's not just amateur hour. And so I just want to make that comment that I think it's
I'm not saying that it is, and I don't mean it in that way. I'm just purely talking, and I'm really talking from this old media sense, and it really deals with the creation of essentially narrative forms that I'm talking about. I'm talking about storytelling.
And I agree with that. I was more referring to Mr. Sulzberger's comments on the news.
I'm surprised because I don't think you and I disagree. I have a good friend here in San Francisco, Joan Walsh, who's the editor in chief of Salon, and they've been doing what you're doing is to a large degree, I think, for a number of years. I mean, that is clearly good, solid journalism. And so you and I are not disagreeing. I think where I started is it doesn't matter how you present the journalism. If you present it on paper, if you present it in a digital form, if you beam it directly into people's brains, it's the quality of the reporting and the editing that's important, and congratulations.
All I'm saying is just the old line companies do not have a monopoly on quality. That's all I'm saying. So
I couldn't agree with you more.
Over here on this side.
Hi, JD Laska from Our Media. I want to pick up on this thread. We actually had it out last year, me and Mr. Diller, on this subject, so I'm going to ask a question of Mr. Sulzberger instead. And that is, you know, you mentioned citizen journalism before, and I don't see the New York Times, from my discussions with a lot of your editors, basically hiring a cadre of citizen journalists to go out and cover things, because of all the different kind of implications of going out and fact-checking and vetting all that information. But I don't see the New York Times embracing the idea of citizen journalism to the extent that I think you have an opportunity to. So when I see, you know, the BBC or I see, you know, the Dallas Morning News actually showcasing photographs of people who are going out and taking photographs of disasters or covering elections or political rallies. I mean, the New York Times reporters and photographers can't be everywhere. And there's an amazing amount of incredible work that's being created by this talent pool of amateurs that John mentioned. And I'm wondering, why don't we see more of that on the Times? Why don't you have these kind of showcases of people who are out there, you know, creating this high quality work? The amateurs.
I think the first answer is you will be seeing more of it, and we are looking at ways of doing that that provides information gathered by, if you will, the amateurs.
I can't see this screen.
That we trust, because at the end of the day, we're putting our name on that work. Now, finding that balance is not easy, and you could argue we've been a little slow at it. I won't disagree with you. But the fact is, as we continue to unveil the Times on the web, continue to unveil the pages of my Times, things that are coming online now, you're going to see the ability to do that in a more robust way than you have in the past.
All right, we have time. I'm sorry, but just for one more.
Hi, Barry. Eben Pagan, Hot Topic Media. I'm the founder of one of these newfangled kind of media models that's been, you know, growing for several years under our own power, profitable, the intersection of media, technology, marketing, a lot of things. And it's neat to see all these other businesses getting recognized as valid models. And, you know, I see that as validation to us in some way. And what I'm looking to you for is, from your perspective, after doing this many times, how does someone in my position look at building long-term equity value? Is there something that you've learned that might be a counterintuitive thing or something somebody who hasn't done it before would know?
Don't sell it.
This is the guy that bought College Humor.
He asked me, he's asking me from his point of view. Believe me, I'll try and sell him to sell it. But in this venue, if you asked me what would I do if I had an idea today, and because I don't think I think money is the easiest thing to obtain today on commercial terms. I don't think, unless you're going to go build server farms, I don't think that these things are particularly capital intensive. And so what I would say is just take your idea. If it resonates with people, keep going. And so long as it interests you, don't sell it to private equity, God forbid. and just ride it. I think that all of that equity is built by holding on. Now, sometimes you've got to sell a little of it. But the idea is, if you want to build equity, hold on to it if you have something valuable.
Thank you.
Very good words to close with. Thank you very much, Barry. Thank you very much. So, Arthur, that was great. Thank you. Okay. Really. Thank you. Great. Thank you very much. Thanks so much.
Barry Diller and Arthur Sulzberger at the Web 2.0 Summit 2006. This podcast is brought to you by the Intel Software Partner Program. Imagine getting to market faster with a world technology leader as your partner. Get your applications to market faster as a member of the Intel Software Partner Program. Fuel your success with access to new Intel platforms and technologies, world-class engineering resources, and effective ways to market and sell your solutions. From strategic planning and product development to marketing and sales, membership in the Intel Software Partner Program brings you new opportunities to benefit every aspect of your business. Are you ready to accelerate your business success? Join the Intel Software Partner Program today at www.intel.com/partner.